a surgical procedure that rendered patients unable to have children. The state of California would ultimately sterilize about 20,000 people. When Louis was in his early teens, a local kid was mistakenly deemed feeble-minded by state authorities, institutionalized, and barely saved from sterilization by a frantic legal effort by his parents. As a chronic troublemaker, a failing student, and a suspect Italian, Louis knew he was just the sort of rogue eugenicists would want to cull. Suddenly understanding what he was risking, he felt deeply shaken. He tried to do better. He scrubbed the kitchen floor, but Louise assumed Pete had done it. He baked biscuits and gave them away. He doled out nearly everything he stole. Each attempt Louis made to right himself ended wrong. At night, he'd lie awake, feeling snared on something, unable to kick free. Far away, he heard the beckoning whistles of trains. Lost in longing, Louis imagined himself on a train, rolling away, growing smaller, until he disappeared. Chapter 2. Run Like Mad. The rehabilitation of Louis Zamperini began with a key. It was 1931, and Louis was 14. While in a locksmith's shop, he heard someone say, if you put any key in any lock, it has a 1 in 50 chance of fitting. Inspired, he began collecting keys and trying locks. He had no luck until he tried his house key on the back door of the Torrance High Gym. When basketball season began, no one understood why the stands were full when so few tickets had been sold. Finally, someone discovered Louis sneaking kids in the back door. Louis was hauled to the principal, who punished him by barring him from athletic and social activities. Louis, who never joined anything, was indifferent. Pete headed straight to the principal. Louis craved attention, Pete told him, but had never won it in the form of praise, so he sought it in the form of punishment. If Louis was recognized for doing something right, he'd turn his life around. Pete asked the principal to let Louis join a sport. When the principal refused, Pete asked if he could live with allowing Louis to fail. It was a cheeky thing for a boy to say to his principal, but Pete was the one kid who could get away with such a remark. The principal gave in. Pete had big plans for Louis. A senior in 1931-32, Pete was a track star, having set the school's mile record of 5 minutes, 6 seconds. Watching Louis, whose getaway speed was his saving grace, Pete thought he saw the same talent. He wanted to make a runner out of him. In the end, it wasn't Pete who got Louis onto a track. It was Louis's weakness for girls. In February, some girls began assembling a team for an interclass track meet, and long-legged Louis looked like he could run. The girls worked their charms, and Louis found himself on the track, barefoot. When everyone ran, he followed, churning along with jimmying elbows. As he labored home last, he heard tittering. Gasping and humiliated, he ran straight off the track and hid under the bleachers. The coach muttered that that kid belonged anywhere but in a foot race. From then on, Pete was all over Louis, herding him out to train and riding his bike behind him, whacking him with a stick. Resentful, Louis dragged his feet, bellyached, and quit. Pete made him keep going. He entered Louis in races, and Louis started winning. Pete was right about Louis's talent, but being forced to run made Louis defiant. At night, he listened to the train whistles, and one day in the summer of 1932, he couldn't bear it any longer. It began over a chore Louis's father asked him to do. Louis resisted. A spat ensued, and Louis threw clothes into a bag and stormed toward the front door. His parents ordered him to stay. Louis was beyond persuasion. As he walked out, his mother rushed to the kitchen and emerged with a sandwich. Louis stuffed it in his bag and left. He was on the front walk when he heard his name called. When he turned, there was his father, grim-faced, $2 in his outstretched hand. It was a lot of money for a man whose pay didn't last the week. Feeling a swell of guilt, Louis took it and walked away. He rounded up a friend, and together they hitchhiked to Los Angeles, broke into a car, and slept on the seats. The next day they jumped a train, climbed onto the roof, and rode north. The trip was a nightmare. The boys got locked in a boxcar so hot they were frantic to escape. Louis found a metal bar, climbed on his friend's shoulders, pried open a roof vent, squirmed out, and helped his friend through. Then they were discovered by the railroad detective, who forced them to jump from the moving train at gunpoint. For several days they walked. One night, as they sat in a rail yard, filthy, sunburned, shivering, and wet, sharing a stolen can of beans, Louis remembered the money in his father's hand, the fear in his mother's eyes as she gave him a sandwich. He stood up and headed home. When Louis came in the door, Louise threw her arms around him, led him to the kitchen, and gave him a cookie. Anthony came home, saw Louis, and sank into a chair, his face soft with relief. Louis went upstairs, dropped into bed, and whispered his surrender to Pete. He was going to be a runner, and he was going to go all out. In the summer of 1932, Louis did almost nothing but run. On a friend's invitation, he went to a cabin in California's high desert. Each morning, he rose with the sun, picked up his rifle, and jogged into the sagebrush. He ran over hills, over the desert, through gullies. He chased bands of horses, trying in vain to snatch a fistful of mane and swing aboard. On his run back each afternoon, he shot a rabbit for supper. In the morning, he rose to run again. For the first time in his life, he wasn't running from something or to something, not for anyone or in spite of anyone. He ran because it was what his body wished to do. All he felt was peace. He came home with a mania for running. On Pete's orders, he ran everywhere. He ran his entire paper route for the Torrance Herald, to and from school, and to the beach and back, veering onto neighbors' lawns to hurdle bushes. He gave up drinking and smoking. To expand his lung capacity, he ran to a public pool, dove to the bottom, grabbed the drain plug, and floated there, hanging on a little longer each time. Eventually, he could stay underwater for 3 minutes and 45 seconds. People kept jumping in to save him. He also found a role model. Track was hugely popular, and its elite performers were household names. Among them was Kansas University miler Glenn Cunningham. As a boy, Cunningham was in a schoolhouse explosion, and his lower body was burned so badly that a month and a half passed before he could sit up. Once he could stand, he pushed himself about by leaning on a chair, his legs floundering. Eventually, hanging off the tail of a horse named Paint, he began to run, a gait that initially caused him excruciating pain. In a few years, he was racing, obliterating his opponents by the length of a home stretch. By 1932, he was a national sensation, soon to be acclaimed the greatest miler in American history. Louis had his hero. In the fall of 1932, Pete entered Compton, a tuition-free junior college, where he became a star runner. In the afternoons, he commuted home to coach Louis, perfecting his stride and teaching him strategy. Pete thought the sprints Louis had been running were too short. He'd be a miler, just like Cunningham. In California, winter-born kids started new grades in January. In the first days of 1933, just before he turned 16, Louis began 10th grade. When the track season began, he set out to see what training had done for him. Competing in black silk shorts that his mother had made from a skirt, He won an 880-yard race, breaking the school record, co-held by Pete, by more than 2 seconds. A week later, he ran a field of milers off their feet, stopping the watches in 5 minutes and 3 seconds, 3 seconds faster than Pete's record. Week after week, he kept winning and getting faster. By late April, his mile time was down to 4 minutes, 42 seconds. "Boy, oh boy, oh boy," read a local paper. "Can that guy fly?" Yes, this means that Zamperini guy. Louis streaked through the season unbeaten and untested. When he ran out of high schoolers to whip, he took on Pete and 13 other college runners in a 2-mile race at Compton. Though he never even trained at the distance, he won by 50 yards. Next, he tried the 2-mile in UCLA's Southern California cross-country meet. Running so effortlessly he couldn't feel his feet touching the ground, he took the early lead and kept pulling away. At the halfway point, he was an eighth of a mile ahead, and observers began speculating on when the boy in the black shorts would collapse. Louis didn't collapse. After he flew past the finish, rewriting the course record, he looked back. None of the other runners was even in sight. Louis had won by more than a quarter of a mile. He felt as if he would faint, but it wasn't from exertion. It was from the realization of what he was. Chapter 3. The Torrance Tornado. It happened every Saturday. Louis went to the track, limbered up, lay in the infield visualizing his coming race, then walked to the line, awaited the pop of the gun, and sprang away. Pete dashed around the infield, yelling instructions. When Pete gave the signal, Louis stretched out his legs, and opponents scattered behind him. Louis glided over the line. Pete tackled him, and the kids in the bleachers cheered and stomped. Louis won so many wristwatches, the traditional prize of track, that he handed them out all over town. Louis's supreme high school moment came in the 1934 Southern California Track and Field Championship. Running in the best field of high school milers ever assembled, he routed them all and smoked the mile in 4 minutes 21.3 seconds, shattering the national high school record. His main pursuer so exhausted himself that he had to be carried from the track. A reporter predicted that Louis's record would stand for 20 years. It stood for 19. Once his hometown's arch-villain, Louis was now a superstar, and Torrance forgave him everything. The Los Angeles Times was striped with stories on the Torrance Tornado. Rumor had it that the Torrance Herald insured Louis's legs for $50,000. Torrancers carpooled to his races and crammed the grandstands. Embarrassed, Louis asked his parents not to come. Louise snuck to the track fence anyway, but got so nervous she covered her eyes. Not long ago, Louis's aspirations had been satisfied by robbing kitchens. Now he latched on to a wildly ambitious goal, qualifying for the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. The games had no mile race, so milers ran 1,500 meters, a little short of a mile. It was a seasoned man's game. Most milers peaked in their mid to late 20s. The 1,500-meter favorite was Glenn Cunningham, who set the mile world record, 4 minutes 6.7 seconds, just after Louis set the high school record. At the 36 games, Cunningham would be almost 27 and wouldn't peak until he was 28. In 1936, Louis would be only 19. But Louis was improving so quickly, he'd lopped a staggering 42 seconds off his mile time in 2 years. Track experts thought he might be the exception to the rule, and after he went undefeated in his senior season, their confidence was strengthened. Louis and Pete believed he could make the team. Louis wanted to run in Berlin more than he'd ever wanted anything. In December 1935, Louis graduated from high school, and days later rang in 1936 with his thoughts full of Berlin, 7 months away. He was buried in college scholarship offers. Pete, now at the University of Southern California, urged Louis to choose USC, but delay entry until fall so he could train. Louis moved into Pete's frat house and, with Pete coaching him, trained obsessively for Berlin. By spring, he realized he wasn't going to make it. Though he was getting faster every day, he couldn't force his body to improve quickly enough to catch his 1,500-meter rivals by summer. He was simply too young. He was heartbroken. In May, Louis was leafing through a newspaper when he saw a story on the Compton Open, a prestigious track meet to be held on May 22nd. The headliner in the 5,000 meters was 26-year-old Norman Bright, America's second-fastest 5,000-meter man behind Don Lash, a 23-year-old record-smashing machine. America would send three 5,000-meter men to Berlin, and Lash and Bright were considered locks. Pete urged Louis to enter Bright's race. "If you stay with Norman Bright," he said, "you make the Olympic team." The idea was a stretch. The mile was four laps. The 5,000 was more than 12. 3 miles and 188 yards. Louis had only twice raced beyond a mile, and the 5,000, like the mile, was dominated by much older men. He had only 2 weeks to train, and with the Olympic trials in July, 2 months to become America's youngest elite 5,000 man. But he had nothing to lose. He trained so hard, his foot bled. The race was a barn burner. Louis and Bright flew off, leaving the field far behind. Lap after lap they dueled, trading the lead and sending roars through the crowd. They turned into the final home stretch together, and with the crowd screaming, finished almost dead even. In the fastest 5,000 run in America in 1936, Bright had won by a glimmer. In June, after Louis performed brilliantly in two more 5,000s, an invitation to the Olympic trials arrived. His Berlin dream was on again. On July 3, 1936, residents of Torrance gathered to see Louis off to the Olympic trials in New York. They gave him a wallet and traveling money, a train ticket, and a suitcase emblazoned with the words, "Torrance Tornado." Fearing the suitcase made him look brash, Louis discreetly stuck adhesive tape over the nickname, then set off. He spent the journey introducing himself to every pretty girl on the train. When the train doors opened in New York, Louis felt he was walking into an inferno. It was the hottest summer on record in America, and New York was especially hard hit. In 1936, air conditioning was a rarity, found only in a few theaters and department stores, so escape was nearly impossible. That week, the heat would kill 3,000 Americans, 40 of them in New York, where it hit 106 degrees. In spite of the heat, Louis had to train. Sweating profusely day and night, training in the sun, unable to sleep in the heat, virtually every athlete lost a huge amount of weight. By one estimate, no athlete lost less than 10 pounds. One virtually moved into an air-conditioned theater, buying tickets to movies and sleeping through every showing. Louis was as miserable as everyone else. His weight fell precipitously. The pre-race newspaper coverage riled him. Don Lash was considered unbeatable. Bright was pegged for second. Louis wasn't mentioned. He was daunted by Lash, but the first three runners would go to Berlin, and he believed he could be among them. "If I have any strength left from the heat," he wrote to Pete, "I'll beat Bright and give Lash the scare of his life." The trials were held at a stadium on New York's Randall's Island. It was just short of 90 in the city, but the stadium was much hotter, probably far over 100 degrees. Everywhere, athletes were keeling over and being carted to hospitals. Louis waited for his race under a scalding sun that he later said made a wreck of me. At last, the men were told to line up. The gun cracked.